In the last episode,
we explored the complex political climate of late 18th century Spain, as well as the turbulent and exploitative relationship it had with its increasingly frustrated colonies. Against this backdrop, we followed a young San Martin as he forged his military skills in the crucible of fire that was Napoleon's invasion of Spain during the Peninsular Wars. In this conflict, we saw him develop his Enlightenment mindset, battlefield philosophy, and ultimately a determination to participate in the liberation of his native homeland. In this, the second part of the documentary series, we follow San Martin's incredible career in South America, from his early victories to the reorganization and formation of a new army, the crossing of the Alps, to the liberation of Chile and Peru, his link-up and enabling of Simón Bolívar, and his continuous antagonism by political elites, eventual self-imposed exile, and lasting legacy.
Heroes and Legends documentary channel. Not just the who, the what, and the where, but also the why.
San Martin had spent his whole career showing unswerving loyalty to his superiors and a total devotion to duty. He took a huge risk returning as a stranger to the land of his birth and participating in a rebellion that would see him marked as a traitor back in Spain. As the highest ranking military officer to defect from the monarchists and join the cause for independence in the entire continent of South America, he knew he would be the center of either celebration or scandal. Indeed, the local government in Buenos Aires did view him with suspicion and were reluctant to give this quiet, though decorated and highly experienced war hero any command that might pose a threat to their grip on power. Despite his Freemason connections, nobody knew him well enough to judge his motives, and it was some time before they felt they could trust him not to be a double agent for the Regency Council back in Cadiz. So while they reluctantly offered him a commission as a lieutenant colonel, he was posted into the countryside and permitted to raise a small cavalry contingent of 120 men to police the border towns along the Paraná River outside Buenos Aires. San Martin now threw himself into the training and drilling of his troops and methodically formed them into a highly maneuverable mounted grenadier regiment according to cutting-edge Napoleonic-era cavalry doctrine. At this time, the loyalist naval forces that were dominating the Rio Plata Basin raided towns up and down its tributaries, the rivers Paraná and Uruguay. Coastal dispatches now mentioned an enemy naval force heading upriver to plunder the mission town of San Lorenzo. So the regiment immediately mobilized and raced upriver under the cover of darkness to position themselves favorably for a surprise attack. As dawn broke on the 3rd of February, 1813, the Loyalist forces began to disembark and make their way towards the town. San Martin organized his regiment into two columns and sounded a saber charge, completely surprising the marauding force and cutting them off in a pincer movement, with San Martin leading the charge of one of the columns. Despite covering fire from the ship's artillery and outnumbering San Martin's regiment by 2-1, the naval assault force was quickly routed with a capture of several artillery pieces. Himself shot in the arm and suffering a saber wound, San Martin's horse was shot out from under him, pinning him under its huge bulk. In a flashback to his past, he was about to be cut down by an enemy officer when one of his own soldiers threw himself in front of San Martin and was mortally wounded, trying to rescue him. The enemy commander was captured and, along with his wounded soldiers, was fed and cordially treated. Instructions were given to his men not to mistreat any prisoners, which so impressed the enemy commander Zabala that he would eventually switch sides and become a staunch subordinate of San Martin in his later campaigns. While the skirmish at San Lorenzo was hardly decisive and made little difference to the war effort, news of the victory spread fast, and it confirmed San Martin's reputation as a bold and innovative commander who led from the front. Meanwhile, the highly centrist triumvirate in Buenos Aires was coming under increasing pressure. Disaffected regional warlords such as Artigas in the Banda Oriental openly rebelled against them, and their now hostile Federalist factions took control of many regional provinces. Alvear, who had accompanied San Martin from London, still only 23 years old, but being well-connected and politically ambitious, was frustrated at the suppression of a progressive social agenda by the triumvirate and the way it was appointed, and convinced San Martin to help him lobby for their replacement. Locals were already rioting in the streets, and so both men stationed troops under their command to protect public buildings and press the Cabildo to dissolve the triumvirate and hold fresh elections. Meanwhile, the situation in the northern provinces was dire. Manuel Belgrano, a veteran and hero from the battles against the British, was a prominent lawyer and economist. He had been given the unenviable task of subduing those provinces and, if possible, the viceroyalty of Peru. Despite the occasional victory, he had, unsurprisingly, being himself a civilian with no real military training, ended in complete failure. Moreover, many of the towns and cities he marched his army of the north through were hostile, and his exhausted and battered troops were in need of rest and resupply. To make matters worse, he had also to contend with the mutiny of entire provinces in the east that left his troops, not unsympathetic themselves, vulnerable to encirclement. Conflicting orders and ignorance of the situation on the ground by the triumvirate often left him having to improvise or even disobey, taking the initiative whenever he could. He even noticed that both his troops and the enemy often fought under the same Spanish flag, so he created a new one based on the Bourbon regime's sky blue and white bands under which his troops fought, without any official approval. Today, Manuel Belgrano, besides being a national hero, is also credited with the formation of the Argentinian flag. Being forced to evacuate entire cities, Belgrano eventually managed to regroup his forces and counterattack the Peruvian royalists in the north, winning a number of significant battles at Tucumán and Salta, securing the border. Eager to capitalize on the momentum, he pursued the enemy into the highlands, but his troops were outmaneuvered and routed by the enemy, whose soldiers were used to fighting in the cold, thin, mountainous air. So, demoralized by yet another defeat, they returned to the plains to lick their wounds and await reinforcements. The new second triumvirate was desperate for some decisive victories, so they sent the newlywed San Martin to relieve Belgrano and take charge of his army. They also sent Alvear to besiege and take Montevideo before Artigas and the Federalistas got there first. Alvear went back and forth with little luck at first, possibly because he spent as much time jockeying for power in Buenos Aires as he did on the battlefield, but San Martin and his regiment left immediately to relieve Belgrano and assess the situation, which was grave. The two men went about building hospitals and fortifying their defences, which improved morale and security considerably. When the situation was stabilised, Belgrano was recalled back to Buenos Aires to answer for his disastrous defeats in the highlands, but San Martin denied his transfer on the pretense of illness. Respectful of the efforts of this complete civilian in holding back the enemy with almost no support for over 2 years. When he finally allowed Belgrano to return in early 1814, the second triumvirate was itself deposed, again largely due to the machinations of Alvear, who had installed his uncle, Gervasio Posadas, to rule as a supreme director on his own. Belgrano's investigation was dropped, and he was sent on a diplomatic mission overseas to win some support from Europe. By now, it was 1815. Napoleon was gone, and Ferdinand was back on the throne. The government in Buenos Aires, if you recall, had so far not declared independence from Spain, claiming its legitimacy as a caretaker government in the absence of the monarch. While it had by now recognized the use of a national flag, had established a national anthem, and even began printing its own money, it stopped short of a proclamation, despite removing royal insignia from stationery and signage, fearing outright civil war by anti-republican factions. Venezuela, on the other hand, had declared independence almost as soon as the king had been deposed, and with Francisco Miranda gone, and his acolyte Simón Bolívar's fortunes now at its head, the independence of the north of the continent came and went a number of times, but its course had clearly been set, while the United Provinces down south floundered in confusion and disarray. The deputies in the Cabildo now faced a major crossroads. To declare independence or not? While San Martín busied himself with military reforms, his old companion Alvear, not receiving the support he expected from his uncle in the siege of Montevideo, but having finally wrangled it into surrender with the help of Irish immigrant naval commander William Brown, rode on the crest of popularity and conspired to have his uncle removed from office and, expeditiously, himself installed in his stead. Alvear was now 25 years old and the supreme director of both the army and the junta. Trying to appeal to both monarchist as well as independence tendencies, Alvear espoused his old friend and fellow Mason Francisco de Miranda's vision of installing an Inca chief from Peru to rule as a constitutional monarch of an independent kingdom. He thought that having a noble, non-partisan head of state to mediate between the various factions would be a compromise that would prevent the chaos that was engulfing local politics and eventually promote stability. But this idea was widely ridiculed and his popularity plummeted as a result. The idea was also promoted by Belgrano, who had unsuccessfully returned from his European diplomatic mission. Belgrano suggested that the European powers would be much more receptive to recognizing a constitutional monarchy than they would a republic, given their nervousness at the chaos caused by Napoleon's French Republic. By installing an indigenous king on the throne, they would both win massive support from the substantial native population, as well as demonstrate national ethnic reconciliation for the genocide perpetrated by conquistadors in the past. It was, in principle, quite a progressive attitude and supported by San Martín as well as a number of provincial and Peruvian deputies, along with a number of other Enlightenment thinkers within the capital. But doing so would have meant shifting the capital from Buenos Aires to Cuzco, something that the privileged patricians of the city rejected outright and vetoed. Alvear had also made overtures to Artigas in the Banda Oriental, as well as to other provincial power brokers, offering them independence and mutual support, but his now well-established reputation as a double-crosser doomed it to failure. Artigas and his fellow federalistas took matters into their own hands and liberated Montevideo from the clutches of Buenos Aires, which not only panicked the former, but also the Brazilian Portuguese in the north, who feared their own country might be overthrown by republicans. So Portugal sent troops in to retake Montevideo with the tacit approval of Buenos Aires, who were only too happy to see the Federalistas preoccupied with fighting someone other than themselves. Alvear's treachery had now not only made Artigas and the Federalistas an enemy, but also allowed the Portuguese to gain a foothold in the region, which was scandalous. San Martín's relationship with Alvear now became increasingly strained, as he admired the ethics and principles of the Federalista leadership and disapproved of the pointless antagonism he held Alvear largely responsible for. San Martín squarely viewed liberation from Spain as the first priority and internal political ideology of secondary importance. King Ferdinand, back in Spain, had meanwhile overturned the initially progressive new constitution from Cadiz and declared a return to absolute rule, which sent shockwaves throughout both Iberian Spain and its increasingly agitated Latin American colonies. Fearing a complete reversal by the king of everything they had fought for, Alvear now approached the British to intervene and govern the country as a protectorate. But a well-founded suspicion of British motives by the populace only caused another scandal for him, and Alvear was forced to resign and go into exile. The government was now forced to make a decision one way or the other, and following a heated congressional debate held in Tucumán province, delegates finally committed themselves to a declaration of independence on the 9th of July, 1816, to the great relief of San Martín, who pushed hard for the cause. He believed that any military expedition into neighboring viceroyalties would be better received if acting as a sovereign nation liberating its neighbors than as a militia of rebels invading their lands. At the conference, he had been nominated to succeed Alvear as Supreme Director, but he declined, preferring to stick to military matters and prepare a new campaign, and nominated instead his friend and fellow Freemason, Juan Martín de Pueyrredón. What form the new government should take was still to be resolved, and the conflict between the centralist Unitarios and their Federalista opponents was already descending into open civil war. The Federalistas had declared the independence of their provinces a year before, and now sent delegates to negotiate further relations within the larger continental framework. But their participation was blocked on technicalities by the conference, who wanted nothing less than total integration and submission to the authority of Buenos Aires, so they returned to their home provinces and prepared to take the fight to the capital. Rather than focus on liberating the country from royalist threats and Portuguese incursions, the government in Buenos Aires was still intent on pursuing a policy of centralizing power as a precursor to anything else, despite having neither the money nor the manpower to achieve it. They were prepared to risk losing the entire country rather than cede economic and political control to a Washingtonian style of state-based democracy. This insistence on centralized power by a rich merchant bourgeoisie increasingly alienated ordinary citizens who turned to the Federalistas as protectors of their rights. Money and troops were being diverted from the security of the country's borders to suppressing internal dissent, which was stifling San Martín's attempts to reorganize the army and take the initiative to the royalists. San Martín had by 1815 long been in contact with pro-independence leaders trying to wrest Chile and Peru from the crown in the west of the continent. He was also in contact with Simón Bolívar, the turbulent and petulant rich kid revolutionary in the north of the continent. Bolívar's unwavering republican ambitions had seen him involved in both coups and capitulations, playing both his benefactors and the Spanish crown, till, betraying his mentor, de Miranda, and seeing him arrested and dying in a prison, Bolívar was now in exile himself. Eventually, winning the support of slave revolutionaries in Haiti, who gave him both cash and troops to reinvade previously lost Venezuelan and Colombian Republican holdings, as long as he promised to abolish slavery wherever he went. Much has been made of Simón Bolívar's contribution to the liberation of South America, and his zeal and vision are certainly worthy of credit, emancipation of slavery being one of his greatest accomplishments. But his Napoleonic style of ruthlessness, imperious arrogance, treachery, and callous exploitation of his supporters made him a poster boy of tyrannical autocracy that has been emulated by Latin American despots and generalissimos ever since. He was a big believer in the firm hand and iron fist style of government. San Martín, on the other hand, though similarly driven by Enlightenment ideals of liberty and brotherhood, was the literal antithesis of Bolívar, being patient, disciplined, courteous, and loyal. His rescue from certain death by the sacrifice of subordinate soldiers on a number of occasions caused him a lifelong deep respect for his troops and a meticulous style of planning that both limited their casualties and lifted their morale. His witnessing of the horrific effect of the Napoleonic Peninsular Wars on civilians made him particularly conscious of winning the hearts and minds of the towns his troops occupied, and he forbade the mistreatment of both civilians and enemy prisoners by his men. The consummate soldier, he found politics distasteful, and a number of academics have proposed that this is why his role in the liberation of South America has been largely ignored by historians, and his example avoided by future leaders, despite being loved and venerated by ordinary people across his native Argentina. Encamped in the foothills of the northern provinces, the nature of the terrain and long discussions with Belgrano convinced San Martin of the futility of trying to take the Peruvian viceroyalty by force from their position in the lowlands. Their cavalry and infantry had demonstrated on numerous occasions that they could hold their own on the plains, but were no match for the mountain divisions of the enemy, who held the high ground and were conditioned to fight in the low oxygen environment. He now recalled his short stint in London, where he was made aware of the Maitland Plan, a risky and incredibly audacious strategy first formulated in 1800 by Major General Thomas Maitland during the time that Britain was still at war with both Spain and Napoleon. The Maitland Plan explained British interests in Buenos Aires and the subsequent failed invasions of 1806 and 1807. In this plan, the Royal Navy was to seize Buenos Aires, securing its all-important supply line to Europe, and then, proceeding east, rapidly marching to occupy a corridor through the interior until they reached the Andes Mountains to secure the small regional city of Mendoza, where a key pass over the mountains lay. From there, the British would coordinate and supply Chilean independence insurgents and together cross the mountains and lay siege to its capital, Santiago. The Royal Navy would provide support from the Pacific and attack the ports along its coast, and when Chile was finally liberated, make their way up the coast to Peru, also liberating its ports and encouraging local rebellions, thus securing for Britain lucrative trade hubs on both the east and the west coasts of South America. Even if they only ended up holding Buenos Aires in the east and Valparaiso, Quito, and a couple of other ports in the west, it would cripple Spanish supply lines and provide rich pickings for the British. Having concluded that a northern advance was untenable, San Martin mulled over the viability of himself carrying out the Maitland Plan and, being personally disinterested in politics, was warmly received by the Federalista leader Martin Miguel de Güemes, whose guerrilla tactics and success against royalist forces impressed San Martin greatly and reminded him of his own activities during the Peninsular War in Spain. He was convinced that the provincial gauchos and the remnants of the northern army were capable of defending the frontier, and so he set about making plans to convert Mendoza, the capital of Cujo province, into a staging point for crossing the Andes with a new army into Chile. Several events now played into his hands, most notably the fledgling provisional government junta in Chile, which had, with the abdication of Ferdinand, developed along similar lines of caretaker governance to that of the United Provinces. This caretaker government now itself ran into trouble. Being bolder than their neighbours across the Andes, they quickly enacted a constitution, significantly empowering colonial self-determination, anti-slavery, and other social and economic reforms that proved popular with the people, but antagonistic to monarchist conservatives and rich landholders. The Chilean Cabildo was headed by the Carrera brothers and Bernardo O'Higgins, an Irish descendant, whose own internal feuding found them surprised by a conservative betrayal. While O'Higgins and the Carrera brothers jockeyed for internal power, they were surprised by a conservative backlash that appealed to the Peruvian viceroy in the north to intervene. The viceroy of Peru, himself unable to penetrate southeast into the United Provinces, sent troops instead down the Chilean coast, gaining support of royalists till they subsequently overthrew the Chilean junta, who styled themselves as the Patria Vieja, or in the Spanish, the Old Homeland, defeating them in the catastrophic Battle of Rancagua, largely due to O'Higgins' impetuosity and failure to coordinate his troops with that of the Carreras. This defeat all but annihilated the independence movement in Chile and restored hard-line royalist rule, with the Carreras O'Higgins and what survivors could escape over the mountains, making it to the safety of the United Provinces in Mendoza. In an attempt to conceal his new plan, San Martin contrived to be relieved of duty in the army under the pretense of severe illness, and serve instead while he convalesced as governor of Cujo province, of which Mendoza was the capital. At first, the government condemned the plan as not only insane, but impossible, withholding funding and fully expecting him to abandon the idea. But San Martin took advantage of his governorship and, with the advice of his civilian economist friends Belgrano and others, implemented a war economy to requisition and manufacture locally the supplies he needed for the expedition. Mendoza became a hive of activity, with clandestine arms factories, textile mills, leatherworks, mining, and gunpowder manufacture. It was even related that local churches donated their bells to the manufacture of artillery pieces, and local women sewed uniforms and blankets for the upcoming freezing journey from their own homes. In his signature style, San Martin, obsessed with attention to detail, meticulously calculated the supplies and equipment that would be needed to execute this highly ambitious plan, and utilized every means at his disposal to prepare his army for the grueling task at hand. Marching an entire army over one of the highest and coldest mountain ranges in the world was a huge gamble, not undertaken since 218 BC, when Hannibal marched his Carthaginian army, elephants and all, over the Italian Alps and into Rome. In the attempt, Hannibal had lost half his troops and almost all of his elephants and cavalry to frostbite and starvation, despite crossing in late spring through well-established mountain passes in a journey that took just over 2 weeks, totally surprising the Romans, who also thought it would be impossible. The Carthaginians ravaged Rome for over 2 years, bringing the city to its knees. San Martin would now be marching his army through the second highest mountain range in the world, with altitudes reaching 4,500 meters and air so thin you could barely walk and quite possibly die from oxygen deprivation. Yet the journey would be 500 kilometers long and take 3 weeks. Casualties had to be kept to a minimum. The refugee Chilean junta and its supporters who poured into Mendoza were quickly recruited into the new army being raised by San Martin, which was to be named the Army of the Andes. Fortunately for him, many of the arriving refugees were blacks, who had been emancipated from slavery under the previous liberal Chilean constitution, and were accompanied by British and other European expats who had long since settled in Chile, but now found themselves exiled. Together with a very large volunteer contingent of freed slaves, gaucho horsemen, and mercenary British veterans who had received citizenship in Buenos Aires after their own failed invasions, San Martin now proclaimed a province-wide emancipation of local slaves and offered them paid service in the army. It soon swelled to 5,000 infantry, supported by 1,500 cavalry, a battalion of 25 artillery guns, and 10,000 pack mules. There was such a preponderance of colored troops that San Martin made the progressive, though scandalous, move of promoting outstanding former slaves to leadership ranks, and though recruitment of slaves wasn't in itself a new phenomenon, he insisted on their serving together in mixed-race battalions rather than in segregated ones, another scandal that nevertheless won him much admiration from his men. The stage was now set for the most audacious Alpine military campaign since Hannibal. In 1815, Mendoza, logistics were always going to be challenging for San Martin's newly raised Army of the Andes, but because of his reputation and political neutrality, his army was supplied by both Unitarian as well as Federalist governors, until the Declaration of Independence in July of 1816, when his friend Pueyrredón, having formed the first national bank and the national mint, finally managed to convince the government to release funds for the Andean campaign. He now set about expanding his espionage network, sending spies and double agents into enemy territory to sow misinformation and cause confusion about his intentions. He established several Masonic clandestine lodges in Chile that served to promote the independence agenda and insurgency. By now, the royalists over in Chile were aware of the potential threat, but they had conflicting information about where the army was going to cross, so they were forced to significantly divide their forces to try and cover the 5 or 6 major passes along the length of the Andes. San Martin sent small detachments to act as diversions at a number of smaller crossing points further along the border, but with O'Higgins promoted as deputy commander, he marched the bulk of the army through 2 passes that would pincer around any enemy on the other side as they neared the capital of Santiago, which lay in the foothills. The crossing was as grueling as expected, with unpredictable blizzards, rock falls, and acclimatization challenges. The army was supplied with onions, garlic, and other foods thought by doctors at the time to minimize altitude sickness, and they moved as fast as circumstances permitted, passing first through dry, dusty river canyons, then dangerous red scree fields, and granite cliffs until they got above the snow line where frostbite, altitude sickness, and cerebral edema were at their most dangerous, all the while dragging 25 cannons over the second highest mountain range in the world. Finally crossing along narrow and slippery serpentine trails, they began their descent into the Chilean hinterland. A third of his soldiers had perished, mostly from frostbite or altitude sickness. Along with this number, he lost half his horses and mules. Devastating, to be sure, but substantially less casualties over a dangerously higher mountain range, longer distance and timescale than Hannibal's attempts against Rome. Several of the other detachments also crossed in reasonable order, only to find the enemy had hurriedly moved on to intercept where they thought the main body of the army was going to be. His spies had done their job, with virtually all detachments descending over the mountains unopposed. These smaller battalions advanced quickly into the lowlands and easily took the lightly defended garrisons up and down the long Chilean coastline at Coquimbo, Copiapó, and Talca, where they cut off or delayed any enemy units travelling by road. The main force, also relatively unopposed, now made plans to attack Santiago in a pincer, surrounding the royalist forces who had marched out to meet them at a ranch called Chacabuco. The southern arm was delayed by difficult terrain and had arrived after San Martin's had already deployed, while O'Higgins, overcome with emotion and his usual Irish-Spanish impetuosity, charged his men straight for the defending line without seeking backup or artillery support. Seeing no alternative to covering the vulnerable flank of O'Higgins, San Martin sounded a general advance, and with the arrival of the southern pincer, the enemy was enveloped and routed by the early afternoon, with huge casualties for the defenders at the loss of only 12 patriots, who had managed to also secure artillery, caches of weapons and supplies. The few surviving royalists fled to the south of the country where they would be harassed by the other battalions and head for royalist-held ports, hoping for reinforcements from the north. In the coming months, they would regroup and press north to endanger Santiago once more. But for now, San Martin and his army marched triumphantly into Santiago the following day, to huge celebrations from the people. They restored the previous caretaker government, which welcomed him as a liberator, and offered him the supreme directorship. Ever the consummate soldier, for the second time and in another country, he again refused the title, insisting that under such historic circumstances, a Chilean citizen would be most appropriate as its first leader, proposing his subordinate and now close friend O'Higgins for the position, who was duly elected to that role. The army was by now low on supplies and there was little money left to pay his troops, so San Martin left O'Higgins in charge of the army while he travelled back to Buenos Aires to report to the government and negotiate for more funds to continue the campaign and push north into Peruvian territory. The whole point of San Martin's campaign was that he believed that the security of the United Provinces hinged largely on the neutralization of the Viceroyalty of Peru, which was the most militantly loyal of all the colonies and had the money and troops to lead a royalist reconquest from their strongholds in the west. If it could be taken, the United Provinces rear would be secure and they could focus all of their military attention to the east and more easily prevail over the Portuguese or royalist forces coming in from Spain. The government had long agreed with this assessment, having formed Belgrano's Army of the North to try and do just that, but his numerous attempts to conquer the highlands from the hinterlands consistently failed. As he made his way back to Buenos Aires, San Martin could scarcely believe the stunning result of his plan, and now put his entire energy into liberating the entire continent into a free and prosperous league of Latin American nations. He believed it was just a matter of time before the other viceroys came to see the futility of supporting a distant and disinterested monarchy and would come over to their side. He was convinced that if the momentum of victories continued, they could sweep up the coast, liberate Peru and Upper Peru, which is modern-day Bolivia, and link up with Bolivar, who, though off to a shaky start, was now making steady progress heading southwards at the head of a huge army of his own. However, Buenos Aires, while impressed with the victory, didn't see things in such a magnanimous way. The government was now bankrupt, having failed to bring the provinces to heel, and were now dealing with a Portuguese invasion entirely of their own making that threatened the Banda Oriental in the northeast of the country. They pressured San Martin to either bring the army home and use it to suppress the rogue Federalistas, or otherwise they would demand the Chilean government compensate them for the costs of liberating their country, which they thought only fair. With no money left in the treasury, emissaries were also sent to both Washington and London to ask for loans, ships, and other aid. But the United States had just done a deal for Florida with Spain and intended to stay neutral. The Carrera brothers, if you recall, who were part of the first autonomous government in Chile, but fled over the Andes along with O'Higgins and the rest of the progressives when it collapsed, did not originally join San Martin's new army in Mendoza. They had a long-running feud with O'Higgins, partly due to their hard-line republicanism, and they accorded little respect to their host, San Martin, who was a conciliatory moderate, like O'Higgins. They caused a number of serious provocations in town, and San Martin had them arrested and sent to Buenos Aires. Now that Santiago had been liberated, they conspired to hire some ships and sail them around the Magellan Straits to depose O'Higgins and take power for themselves. So Pueyrredón confiscated their ships and imprisoned them in Buenos Aires once again. The last thing Buenos Aires needed right now was another scandal with another neighbour. Meanwhile, San Martin corresponded directly with Britain to try and arrange support from the Royal Navy. A small squadron of ships under Admiral William Bowles was dispatched, but nothing eventuated from it. Having exhausted all possibility of funding and support, San Martin returned to Chile empty-handed, but determined to find ways of raising funds there, as he had done in Mendoza. By now, he was a father, his wife having given birth to a daughter, Mercedes, some time ago, but due to frailty, she remained in Buenos Aires, and so he travelled back alone. Arriving once again in Chile, he was alerted of the presence of a fresh force of royalists in the south, who had regrouped, were reinforced by sea, and were now marching north to retake Santiago. Reluctantly, towns along the route were ordered to evacuate and take all livestock and grain, burning crops as they went to deny the royalists any field supplies. He knew this force would be better prepared, and he urged the Chilean government to declare independence immediately, to legitimize the struggle of its government and inspire support from ordinary people. So it was that Chile declared its independence from Spain on the 18th of February 1818, a year after the Battle of Chacabuco and the liberation of Santiago. While superior in numbers, the Patriot forces lapsed in discipline and organization in San Martin's absence, and despite having good intelligence on Royalist troop movements, could not mobilize and coordinate in time to repel a night attack, which occurred on a plain near the main road to Santiago, called Cancha Rayada. In the melee, O'Higgins was shot in the arm, San Martin's aide-de-camp was killed, and a significant number of troops fled the field, forcing their hasty withdrawal back to Santiago. While casualties were negligible, it put the army on the back foot. To regain the initiative, San Martin now deployed his reorganized forces along the bank of the Maipo River, just south of the city, awaiting the Royalist army, who thought they had just routed the rabble of patriots and were casually making their way north, expecting to take Santiago without much resistance. By the time they arrived, they were surprised to see San Martin's army, fully deployed on favorable terrain, with artillery in support, and hardly in the state of panic the Royalist had expected. Hastily deploying his own men as best he could, the enemy commander, Don Mariano Osorio, took an inferior defensive position, which was exploited by the Patriots' mounted grenadiers, who charged with the support of both the infantry and an artillery barrage. O'Higgins, still nursing a gunshot wound and late to the fray, typically charged in recklessly with his own men, and they managed, by the end of the day's fighting, to rout the entire Royalist enemy forces, capturing all of their top commanders, guns, supply, and money wagons, pursuing the fleeing infantry until the entire army was either captured or killed, at the expense of only a few hundred patriots. News of the stunning victory rapidly spread throughout the continent and into Europe, with San Martin gaining praise from all quarters. Osorio escaped with a few hundred cavalry, but the Battle of Maipo was a decisive victory that not only collapsed all Royalist resistance in the south, but also firmly cemented Chilean independence. The country would never be threatened by Royalist forces again. Nevertheless, they still held key ports along the eastern seaboard, and O'Higgins lamented that the country would never be secure till the Spanish navy in the Pacific was neutralized. San Martin agreed, and so they again sent agents to London and Washington, appealing for ships and support, in order to take the coastal forts in Peru, as the land route north through the Atacama Desert was even more hostile than the mountains, and would decimate any army that tried to go overland. For the battles to come, they could not dare risk losing a single man to misadventure. Now that there was a very real opportunity to crush the Peruvian viceroyalty and finally secure the United Provinces' northern borders, San Martin traveled again to Buenos Aires, fully expecting his government to support the next phase of the campaign, given the direct benefit of the outcome. It was while he was traveling back that the Carrera brothers, escaped and trying to return to Chile, were captured in the vicinity of Mendoza and unceremoniously executed, not an unusual act in itself, for which some blame was apportioned to San Martin, though some historians lay the murder squarely at O'Higgins or Pueyrredón's feet. Back in the United Provinces, the conflict with the Federalistas had by now devolved into all-out civil war, and the Treasury was pouring all its resources into that conflict. This only emboldened the Portuguese, who resumed their foray into the country around Montevideo, eventually conquering it, so once again the Cabildo began making further demands on San Martin to come home. But he had no intention of participating in a civil war, raising a sword to his own countrymen, when they had yet to secure their own liberty from Spain. He and the Cabildo in Buenos Aires knew full well that most of his army was now composed of Chileans, ex-slaves, and provincial Argentines, sympathetic, if nothing else, to the Federalist cause, and if he tried to force them back over the mountains and into this civil war, desertion would inevitably evaporate the entire army, leaving barely a handful of reluctant fighters, of no use to anyone. Not even San Martin's reputation could convince them to fight. Trying to break the deadlock, he promised to use his leverage with the Federalistas to instead negotiate a ceasefire and to deal with the Portuguese once the Spanish threat was neutralized. So reluctantly, Pueyrredón's cabinet, seeing little alternative, promised him a reasonable sum of money to support the purchase and fit out of ships for the campaign against Peru. Satisfied, San Martin returned to Mendoza with his wife and daughter, only to be told by dispatch upon his arrival that the government had reneged on its promise and withheld the funds after all. Disgusted, San Martin resigned his commission, planning to continue on to Chile independently at the head of the now multinational army, but Pueyrredón begged him to withdraw and reinstated the allocated funds, putting his own reputation on the line and his future as a political leader in jeopardy. O'Higgins used these funds to purchase a small number of modest ships for the fledgling Chilean Navy, and as they assembled in the main port of Valparaiso, they were joined by large numbers of veteran British sailors and their families, who had been discharged at the conclusion of the war against Napoleon and were now desperate for employment. They were led by Scotsman Thomas Lord Cochrane, a decorated and highly experienced Royal Navy captain, famous for his daring, creative, and suicidal exploits that terrified both French and Spanish enemy fleets. Lord Cochrane had returned home as a war hero, but his ferocious naval reputation was marred by insubordination, acts of piracy, and theft under the pretense of pay owed. He was also indicted in a stock market scandal in London that saw him imprisoned for fraud. Exiled from Britain and on the lookout for a new adventure, he quickly agreed to lead the Chilean Navy, settling with his family in Valparaiso, taking Chilean citizenship and being given the rank of Vice Admiral by the government. A tireless worker, he immediately set to work, prowling the seas to the south, where Osorio and his escaped forces were licking their wounds and hoping for reinforcements. Soon enough, Cochrane's ships came upon a frigate and a number of transport vessels, which they quickly overwhelmed and added to their own number. Returning in triumph, the High Command now set about planning a strategy to advance to the north. To secure the sea lanes, they had first to neutralize the last two Spanish warships that were anchored in Callao, a highly fortified port servicing the capital of Lima. Callao was the richest and most important trading port along the entire west coast of the continent, so taking it would spell the end for the Viceroyalty of Peru. Cochrane attempted a raid, but was foiled by thick fog, blundering into the direct line of fire of the enemy, and was almost obliterated by the guns of the fortress. Having learned his lesson, he now turned his attention to the south once more, where he proposed taking the heavily defended fort of Valdivia, which was rejected by O'Higgins as too risky and of minimal priority. Undeterred, or perhaps even encouraged by the odds, with his usual disregard for authority, he disobeyed orders and took several hundred men with him on a stealth mission to attack the forts using small rowboats to sneak into the harbour at night. To everyone's surprise, he managed to create such diversionary chaos that the royalist forces fled, assuming a major patriot assault, and so he returned to Valparaiso, receiving a hero's triumph instead of a court-martial. Despite his popularity with the locals, San Martin, O'Higgins, and the High Command became increasingly concerned at the recklessness and unnecessary risks Cochrane was taking with their vulnerable squadron, having barely scraped enough money together to establish it in the first place. Chile, like the United Provinces, was effectively bankrupt and could ill afford a major loss of either ships or manpower. Ultimate success still depended on the liberation of Peru, the most well-defended and loyalist stronghold on the entire continent. Cochrane, though brilliant, was beginning to look like a loose cannon that could potentially undermine the entire war effort. His arrogance, dismissive British condescension, and narrow focus caused continual bickering about strategy. Being one for quick results, Cochrane was keen for an all-out assault on Callao, believing that a swift and decisive taking of the seaport would see the collapse of the viceroyalty and a quick victory. San Martin, on the other hand, expected fierce resistance from the well-supplied fortress that would be better prepared and with much higher morale than those who were defending Valdivia against Cochrane's earlier night raid. The Patriot Army, now numbering just over 4,000 men, had little artillery support that could reply to the guns of the fortress, and the Royalists had four times the number of troops under arms, many of them in regional centres, that could be mustered quickly for a counteroffensive. The surrounding towns and villages were similarly hostile, and even the indigenous Mapuche chiefs, who could mobilize thousands of warriors within days, were hostile. A massive counterattack would be fatal, and all the other commanders agreed that a more cautious strategy, based on patience, isolation of outlying enemy reinforcements, and negotiation with the city, was more prudent in the long run. Ever conscious of winning hearts and minds, in August of 1820, San Martin had Cochrane's squadron transport the army to Pisco, south of Callao, where they disembarked without incident and marched north, unmolested, to lay siege to Lima. San Martin brought with him a printing press and poured reams of propaganda into the city and surrounding towns to encourage the citizens to revolt. He was also in regular communication and negotiation with the viceroy himself, imploring him to accept the inevitable liberation of Latin America and open the gates to avoid bloodshed. Having learned much about the tenacity of Highland soldiers during his time with Belgrano, he also sent delegates into the mountains to negotiate with the indigenous leadership and other loyalist strongholds, promising a progressive social agenda for Criollo people and an emancipation for all slaves that joined his cause, all in the hope of undermining the viceroy and effecting a coup. He knew that Simón Bolívar, despite earlier setbacks, was by now making his way south, and they would soon enough link their forces, so he was patient, expecting that it was just a matter of time before they linked up and starved out the enemy. News of a rebellion in Spain that forced the king once again to submit to the constitution he had previously overturned in Cadiz also encouraged the patriots, as the relevance of the crown was now increasingly fading. None of this impressed the aggressive Cochrane, who was furious at all this waiting around, so in November of 1820, he took a small contingent of sailors in canoes to sneak into Callao Harbour under cover of darkness to raid and capture the last remaining Spanish frigate in another act of brilliance that finally neutralized any maritime threat the enemy might pose. Following that, he had little else to do but blockade the harbour while the siege continued, so his resentment of San Martin grew into open slander and accusations of cowardice and incompetence. Much of our information about San Martin's Peruvian strategy comes from Cochrane's later autobiography, and may explain why the great liberator receives less than flattering mention by English-speaking historians, when compared to the swashbuckling of heroes such as Bolívar and Cochrane. The siege was taking longer than expected, and along with some serious skirmishes with outlying loyalist towns, money and supplies were once again running low. San Martin urgently wrote to Bolívar, encouraging him to march as quickly as possible to put further pressure on the viceroy, who had, as expected, been deposed by a more amenable replacement, though they were still nowhere near a capitulation or a negotiated settlement. Negotiations continued, with the viceroy proposing to accept the reinstated Spanish constitution, while San Martin had demanded nothing less than a declaration of independence, for which he was prepared to entertain a constitutional monarchy of any independent prince. He didn't want to see the rights of a new country swallowed up by the interests of a larger empire, as had long been the case in the Americas. This is one reason why he even supported the idea of an Incan king as a constitutional monarch. Finally, with the port blockaded, supplies critical, and the situation hopeless, increasing numbers of regional towns and regiments joined the Patriots' cause, causing the Viceroy finally to capitulate, with the gates being thrown wide open. San Martin now marched the army into Lima to a huge celebration. His refusal to storm the city meant that there were few casualties on either side, and Peruvians saw him celebrated as a liberator rather than a conqueror. He immediately set out to form a new government, which declared independence on the 28th of July, 1821. The Viceroy and his entourage deserted the city, leaving few citizens of standing qualified to take charge of the government. So San Martin was appointed as an interim protector of Peru until sufficient delegates could be recalled to form a more inclusive national parliament. He was conscious of the highly conservative stance of the local population, so he enacted progressive reforms cautiously, taking pains not to alienate some of its wealthier people. He nevertheless implemented a phasing out of slavery, granted citizenship and equal rights to indigenous populations, abolished the Inquisition, and enshrined freedom of speech. Things we all take for granted today, but at the time were highly controversial. Busy with internal affairs, San Martin proposed to Cochrane that he should continue his services by founding a Peruvian navy, for which he would secure ongoing pay directly from Peru. Otherwise, if he remained a Chilean officer, he would now need to seek his salary from O'Higgins. Cochrane viewed this as a cop-out, and by now their relationship had become so hostile that he took what ships and officers would join him and left Callao, hunting the remaining few Spanish ships in the region on his own. The rest remained and formed the nucleus of the new Peruvian navy. Cochrane finally cornered the last two Spanish warships in the port of Guayaquil in what is today Ecuador, but they surrendered to the port authorities who had just declared independence, effectively denying Cochrane and his crew what they considered a fair booty of war. Undeterred, Cochrane plundered a Peruvian government cache of treasure and made off with it, ostensibly as back pay owed to himself and his crew, in an act that was not unusual for him, but of course a court-martialable offence. He eventually returned to Valparaiso after 20 months at sea, with a depleted navy having lost his best warships to wear and damage, and though greeted as a hero by the population, the Chilean government, now also becoming tired of O'Higgins' leadership style, deposed him in the usual custom and also gave Cochrane a cold reception, fearing he might provoke a war with Peru. They sidelined him for some months until, bored and restless as usual, he took leave and ended up serving Brazil, who was itself now undergoing a war of independence from Portugal. Cochrane never set foot in Chile again. Meanwhile, Simón Bolívar had finally taken Caracas at the decisive Battle of Carabobo, finally liberating both Colombia and Venezuela, and was finally heading south to reinforce the liberation of the province surrounding Guayaquil. Unable to overcome the enemy, Bolívar requested aid from San Martín, who happily dispatched 1,300 troops to assist. Taking advantage of his position, and without consulting his ally, Bolívar occupied its capital Quito and quickly annexed the port of Guayaquil to Colombia, without the consent of Ecuadorian insurgents, who became incensed at the betrayal of their independence aspirations. Peruvian officials were similarly furious that their troops had participated in a land grab by Bolívar and demanded San Martín challenge Bolívar's claim to the port. So he arrived in Guayaquil on the 26th of July, 1822, enthusiastically greeted by the duplicitous Bolívar as though he had done nothing wrong, and they spent the next 2 days in meetings discussing their vision of the future of the continent. Despite their common goal of liberation and tenacious commitment to success, Bolívar was an avowed republican, a ruthless authoritarian, ambitious and vain. San Martin was his antithesis. His experience of continental politics had left him with serious doubts as to the current ability of its population to implement a stable democratic republic. He felt, as did many others, that for the time being, stability and prosperity would be best served by installing an appropriate constitutional monarchy, as in Britain, which was, at the time, at the height of its powers and lacking in any of the political turmoil which seemed to plague republican governments. He was, perhaps uniquely among generals of his time, highly concerned about the welfare of both his troops and the civilian populations of the regions they occupied, preferring caution, meticulous planning, and precision in his campaigns, rather than reckless slaughter, conquistadorial oppression, and expendability of his soldiers, that seemed to characterize armies of the Napoleonic age. He was discreet in all his dealings and magnanimous to his foes, refusing the seductions of political power and concentrating all his efforts on the main priority, liberty for his people. The last remaining task was now to subdue the Peruvian highlands, which were still a threat and too remote, inhospitable, and challenging for either of the generals to achieve on their own. They discussed merging their armies as well as attacking together, but the ever-vain Bolívar was not about to share the spoils or the title of ultimate liberator with anyone. Bolívar imperiously envisioned himself as sole architect of a liberated megastate, even drawing up a constitution to be forwarded to the rest of the newly liberated nations to submit to. He refused to lend his troops to San Martin, whose education, rank, experience in the terrain, and local knowledge of the enemy clearly marked him as the wiser choice of field commander. Peru being barely established, and with no more aid to be had from either Buenos Aires or Santiago, San Martin could not raise the funds or the fresh troops required to complete the task on his own. Bolívar, meanwhile, being in supreme command of his own government, could count on both cash and the forced enlistment of the civilian population to swell the ranks of his army. San Martin's shunning of the reins of power now put the writing on the wall, and seeing no way to talk sense to Bolívar, he offered himself as second in command, committing his entire army to the Venezuelan. Bolívar knew full well that subordinating a general of such standing would not only steal his thunder and highlight his own vanity, but possibly also cause mutiny among the troops, so he declined the offer, leaving them at an impasse. Nobody knows exactly what was said in the closing hours of their deliberations, but the result was that San Martin resigned as general of the army and retired. Bolívar would have his crowning glory. In the banquet that followed, Bolívar rose and offered a toast. "To the two greatest men in South America, the general San Martin and myself." To which San Martin rose, and in words that typify their contrasting personalities, replied, "To the prompt conclusion of the war, the organization of the different republics of the continent, and the health of the liberator of Colombia." In one sentence, he eloquently demonstrated his vision as a leader, while humiliating the arrogant upstart at the same time. Returning to Lima, and finding the government furious at his concessions to Bolívar, San Martin felt that resigning as protector was the only honorable thing he could do, and so he left Peru to its fate and returned south to Valparaiso, where he was offered an estate and sums of money in reward for services to the nation. But he declined them and diverted the funds to create the National Library in Santiago, and converted his estate into a hospital for women, in honor of his wife, who had recently died. He returned to Mendoza, planning to retire there, but the civil war had seen the Federalistas finally defeat the Unitarian regime in 1820, and they now offered him the supreme directorship a second time. Yet again he declined, and returned to Buenos Aires to spend more time with his daughter. His reception there was frosty. His in-laws were unhappy at his absence during the death of his wife, and many of the patrician politicians, notably among them Bernardino Rivadavia, were resentful of his not supporting them during the Civil War, when they were defeated by the Federalist forces at the Battle of Cepeda. The Unitarians believed that his presence would have stabilized the internal politics of the state, and they never forgave him for his refusal to cooperate with them. He was surveilled by agents and harassed to exile himself abroad, fearful of his Federalist sympathies. Heartbroken, he took his daughter and sailed to France, but the restored French monarchy denied him entry, so he departed for London instead, where he learned of the disbanding of his beloved Mounted Grenadier Regiment. After some time, they moved again to Brussels, where he enrolled his daughter in school and intended to stay for the duration of her education. It was here that he learned of Simon Bolivar's final victory in what, unsurprisingly, came to be called Bolivia, finally concluding the War of Liberation for South America. He was now made aware of a new campaign to liberate the Banda Oriental from the Brazilian Portuguese, who had occupied it while he was planning his Andean crossing in 1816. Eager to assist, he enthusiastically wrote to the government in Buenos Aires offering his services, but received no reply. Possibly because Rivadavia, now head of the newly proclaimed nation of Argentina, still despised and resented him. As usual, this administration didn't last long either, and Rivadavia was soon deposed and pro-federalist politicians, headed by Manuel Dorrego, returned to power. Feeling much more comfortable serving under that regime, San Martin set sail for Buenos Aires in 1828. But the war for the Banda Oriental ended while he was en route, with British mediators convincing both essentially depleted and bankrupted parties that the most practical resolution to their competing territorial claims would be to agree to the formation of a new country, which they would call Uruguay. Uruguay would act as a buffer state and as a compromise to their own territorial ambitions. By the time San Martin's ship reached Rio de Janeiro, discontent about the compromise among the army that had fought against Brazil had grown sufficiently that Unitarian leader Juan Lavalle instituted yet another coup, this time to depose Dorrego, who was soon rounded up with his supporters and, in the usual manner, executed without trial in the countryside. Encouraged, Lavalle began reversing the Federalist agenda and used the army to reinforce compliance in the provinces, even offering San Martin presidentship, now for the third time, if he would support the Unitarian government. But once again San Martin declined, remaining aboard the ship when it docked in Buenos Aires and returning, in disgust, back to Europe. The merry-go-round of Latin American politics continued, and once again came full circle as the Federalists caught up with Lavalle too, and he was forced to resign, being replaced by another Federalist leader, Juan Manuel de Rosas. Rosas made some headway in pacifying the situation back home, and also went some way toward reconciliation of the two factions, earning San Martin's admiration from afar, and they maintained a warm correspondence for some years. Soon enough, trouble now began in Belgium, with a separatist movement against the Netherlands in 1830. The Belgians offered him a commission in their army, but San Martin felt it dishonourable to take up arms against a government that had given him a new home. Together with his daughter, he now moved to Paris, and with illness and poverty setting in, offered his services one final time to Rosas, who was in a dispute with the French over access to the Rio Plata Basin. But the latter declined, hoping for a quick diplomatic resolution, which didn't happen, and he also wanted to avoid embroiling the aging hero in an international incident. The Argentines eventually prevailed, and San Martin passed away peacefully in his home in the north of France, shortly after hearing the news in 1850, at the age of 72. He had stated in his will that he wished his heart to be buried in Buenos Aires, but ongoing factional infighting prevented any return for decades, as the Porteños, or Buenos Airean patricians, still resented his legacy of neutrality. By 1880, his legend had grown to such a status among the common folk, however, that his body was finally repatriated, where it was received on the dock by the only 7 remaining granaderos still alive who had been under his command. They dressed in their old uniforms and escorted his body to the cathedral, where they formed an honor guard all night, then dispersed at dawn the next day, not to be seen again. A magnificent monument was erected in a special alcove where his body now lies, and with the reforming of his personal regiment some years later, an honor guard representing those 7 last grenadiers marches out every morning from the Casa Rosada that optimistically symbolizes the union of both white Unitarian and red Federalist colors. They march to his tomb to relieve the previous night's vigil so that he is never again abandoned by his people. Despite the chaotic political culture, exiles, executions, reprisals, persecutions that characterized 19th century Latin American politics, it is interesting to note that across not only Buenos Aires, but indeed the entire country, statues, streets, parks, squares, and suburbs are named after virtually all of the various factional leaders that have come and gone. One leader may execute his predecessor or exile them for treason or any number of other crimes, but interestingly, they don't seem to tear down each other's statues or rename streets or squares for the opposing faction when they are deposed. Argentines seem to accept that great leaders may be notorious and even despised, but they accept them for the role they played in the history of the nation, for which they continue to honor them, because they are Argentines. So it is that a quiet, parochial Freemason is buried in the Catholic cathedral of a city that once turned its back on him. Today, though he is not widely known to the outside world, General José Francisco de San Martín y Matorras is venerated not only as El Libertador, the great liberator of Argentina, Chile, and Peru, and enabler of Simón Bolívar's ultimate victory in the Americas, but also as a shining example of honorable conduct and love of country, for his humanity, his principles, and resolve in the face of overwhelming odds. In a world of demagoguery, avarice, and power hunger, he stands as a model of integrity and humility for all of us. He showed us that a decent human being can achieve the liberation of an entire continent if only he remains at all times true to himself and unwavering in his resolve. We can only hope that his legacy eventually outshines that of those whose fortunes ride on the back of his service to freedom, and that his aspirations for the people of Latin America will someday see the kind of prosperity and peace he always dreamed was possible for them.
If you enjoy this content, please take a moment to support my work by making a small donation through the links on the podcast website, or better still, by signing up as a Patreon supporter, where you can communicate with me directly, engage with the Heroes and Legends community, and get better insights and even involvement in my work and future videos. A video montage of this podcast also appears on our YouTube Heroes and Legends documentary channel. Please feel free to visit, like and share, and as always, thanks for listening.